Hi, welcome to my podcast. I am Dr. Lauren Goodall. I am a clinical psychologist. I've spent over 2 decades working with people, mostly in private practice settings. My specialty is mood disorders. That would be depression, anxiety, bipolar, and pretty much every distinction in between there. My other specialty is differential diagnosis. And the best way to explain that is from more of a medical paradigm. For instance, if you have the symptom of a headache, you may have high blood pressure. If you have the symptom of a headache, you may have high blood sugar. And if you have the symptom of a headache, you may have a brain tumor. Well, psychology is similar in the sense that you can have a symptom and it can cover several different diagnoses. My job has always been to try to find the best diagnosis or the closest diagnosis, obviously to obtain better treatment outcomes and better treatment altogether. A little bit about my work history. My early years, I worked in a private psychiatric hospital treating children, adolescents, adults. I've done a large degree of psychological testing. I've also worked for 2 behavioral healthcare agencies doing what we call utilization review. And the best way to describe utilization review is they give you a cross-section of clients' charts. And many of these charts have multiple diagnoses. And my job is to ask, you know, what makes this diagnosis more effective than this diagnosis? And so much so that I call myself kind of the garbage can queen. Clean up the diagnosis and make sure that the treatment is aligned to get a better outcome. I have done large group supervision. I have testified in court, and I have also published. And my book is Bipolar is Not an STD, and it's available at Amazon. And I will be using it as a platform to discuss issues of mental health, specifically related to mood disorders and personality disorders. My goals with this podcast is informational and educational. The hope is that you may hear something that can be helpful, that you can take to your provider to ask better questions. I don't believe in coincidence per se. I think that if you've found this podcast, it may be for you, but it may also be for somebody close to you, or somebody in your area of influence that you may be able to help ask some different questions or present them to the provider. The goal is always to try to get people better faster, and that is what prompted me to write the book and also to do this podcast. I think it's really important to say that I am entirely very grateful to the clients I have worked with. I find them to be amazing people. The reason I find them amazing is because they carry heavy. Whether that's families, whether that's raising kids, whether that's dealing with a marital issue, or a high-end professional position, or a health issue. What I think people don't understand is that there's a lot of stereotypes out there that people with mood disorders do not succeed in life, and nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, there's a lot of celebrities, or quite a few, I should say, that come forward, which I think is just wonderful, saying, hey, look, you know, I deal with depression, or I deal with anxiety, or I deal with bipolar, and I do, you know, and I'm a very successful person. People need to hear that, because for years and years, there was just nothing but generational stigma and what I just call, quote, bad information. Before I open the book and read some excerpts from it, I'm going to say that I think in order to be a good psychologist, you have to have a level of empathy and basic regard for the human condition. Those are prerequisite. I also think that somewhere in your life, you have to have some access to, some exposure to, or some experience base that you cut your teeth on related to psychology. And so with that, I think it just makes you a better therapist. It helps tune you in a bit tighter. And as I said, if you don't have much empathy, you're not going to be very good in the entire process. So with that, I'm just going to open my book and start there. About you. You probably haven't had the easiest life, and you may be wondering if life is really worth putting effort into. Maybe you've been repeatedly let down by another person. Maybe you just want to have a relationship, but all you find is a relationship with relationships, as in plural, not what you had in mind. Maybe you battle against depression. Maybe it's anxiety that you're trying to fight. Maybe you get angry. Maybe you battle drugs. Maybe your biggest battle is within yourself. My starting point in psychology was an ending. When you get to the hospital, the emergency staff is awkward because they know that your person is dead. They just transport the body and inform the family when they arrive. I bolted into that room to try attending to someone who couldn't be attended to try to talk to somebody who couldn't be talked to. Me and my nightmare of loss, which haunted me for most of my life, was being alone in that room with a dead, going cold body that I could not fix. The person I counted on was a big person with an unfortunate big addiction. I hung over a dead body, trying to make some kind of desperate plea deal that could not be made. I don't know, and this is figuratively speaking, who had more demons at the time, him or me. However, it's hard to avoid inner demons. Demons aren't hard to acquire. Demons of comparison, demons of less than, and demons of being completely alone. When you have something to prove to yourself, you work all the time. So that's what I did. In order to be any good at working in the field of psychology, I had to have some basis of understanding hell. That wasn't hard to come by. This quote is from Randall Wallace from the movie Secretariat, Making of a Champion. Quote, life is about finding how far you can go, how fast you can run, and you never know until you try, until you run. This book is for anyone who had to run a race that they didn't think they had in them, whether it was your second broken marriage, your kid in the jail cell, your cancer, your fleet of mobile rage. Let's face it, this wasn't supposed to be your race, but now it is. Okay. I'm going to talk a little bit about the field of psychology. And specifically, areas of psychology addresses thoughts, emotions, motivation, and behavior. And these are not distinctly separate, okay? These are not independent actors. They are commingled very closely. And so, for instance, you will not have a person who experiences a sad mood or a depressed mood and have happy thoughts. That is not going to happen. These pieces align, okay? And so thoughts, emotions, behavior will all interconnect. For instance, in the field of psychology specific to depression, where you find depression, anxiety, we say are comorbid. What does that mean? That means they hang together. You get one, you get the other, you know, and the question then becomes which one is more predominant, but you get one, you do get the other. And there's a lot of books out there selling, you know, change your thinking. Thinking is definitely a big piece of psychology. If you change your thinking, you can be successful. But that's really only one piece of the puzzle. I also think that the biology of the brain influence is huge, or I call it the great influencer, okay? The brain constantly, you know, in social media speak, sends text to different organs to release hormones and chemicals. And all of that is your basic infrastructure to work from. And whether or not you've got great senders and great receivers, now that's the question, okay? But that's just one piece of psychology. So if you are thinking that a psychologist or therapist is just about talking to people, then I would say you're in error. It's a lot more than that. In fact, I look at the field of psychology like a group of variables and a factorial equation. You know, in statistics, there is this thing called factor loadings. So it's not necessarily what happens to you, okay? It's the weight or the factor loading attached to it. So you can go through a pretty tough experience. And this is for maybe people who want to be therapists or psychologists, just as a frame of reference. Just because a person goes through a tough experience doesn't mean that that is carrying the heaviest factor loading on them. That isn't the greatest weight, okay? It's a combination of all these different pieces, from thoughts, emotion, motivation, behavior, biology, external environment, health factors, job factors, relationship factors. And you can see, you can accumulate these factors. And so I always just caution, you know, not only what is, you know, people might want to say, well, you know, I want to spend a lot of time in your early years. And that might not be where the client's issues really are. They might have some pieces there. But even if they have significant pieces there, that doesn't mean that that is really where they have to start and stay, okay? Or spend lengthy periods of time. Consider it an option to always ask your therapist and just discuss and say, you know what, this part of my life really doesn't bother me. I'd like to, you know, hit the fast forward button and talk more relevantly in another area. And most therapists are pretty open-minded to that concept as long as they've got a general template of what's been going on. Usually they will move with you. The themes of psychology. I'll throw some of those out there. One of the themes is grief and loss. People assume, oh, that's about when somebody dies around you. Well, yes and no. Okay. Person can have a huge amount of grief in their life and nobody died. However, they may be dealing with achievement issues or battles all along their journey. And so there's a lot of grief built into their equation. I use this term called ANT, A-N-T. I guess I should say I coined it, but it's based on other psychological principles that are endemic to psychology, such as, so I call it ANT, and it relates to attachment, neglect, trauma. Attachment is important because for a child growing up, they have to have a sense of security, a sense of emotional well-being, that their caretakers will attend to them. That sense of trust or mistrust carries throughout their life and affects their relationships throughout their life or their ability to form relationships or feel secure. So that's attachment in a nutshell, a super tight nutshell. Neglect is neglect. And I'm not going to bother discussing that at this point. It's just pretty much not being attended to and physically or emotionally. And trauma is, I think most people are aware, what trauma is. Relationships. People come into treatment to deal with relationships, or what I call short end of the stick relationships, where people feel like, you know, they are the person that usually gives. They are usually the supportive person. They end up caring a lot in a relationship. So relationships will always be a factor. The book talks, has a significant section on relationships, and particularly short end of the stick relationships. We also talk about family relationships, friendships, acquaintances. These are all part of the social dynamic. So these are some psychology influences. And when I think of the field of psychology, I think of, you know, mental health as having medical influences. So I see a lot of mental health as a medical issue. Because to say that it isn't is like saying, you know, it's like saying the accelerator in the car has nothing to do with driving speed. Okay. Of course it does, you know. So there are influences that really, I think, because you have to take into account the biology and the psychology of a person, fall more into a medical domain. So I talk about that at great length in my book and implications surrounding that. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of my beliefs. I believe in terms of diagnoses that less is best. For instance, in the area of psychological testing, computerized, it's not uncommon to see multiple diagnoses. By multiple, I'm talking about, I like the word sporting, three diagnoses, three or more. And I think that although there's a lot of pieces that I like about computerized psychological testing, I think in order to use it, you have to understand its limitations. And what loads the questions. And if you don't know those things, then, you know, that's a big red flag and that's a huge caution, because you could really be over-diagnosing somebody pretty easily. And so if you're the person that has, say, three diagnoses, I'd say you go to your therapist or psychologist and say, hey, you know, what makes this similar? What makes this different? You know, And usually they can tighten it up and should be able to tighten up. Let's just put it that way. So less is best from my vantage point over the years. And I also believe that good medication management matters. Okay, I've seen many people pull out of a suicidal spin because of some good medication. For instance, I've had clients that would be referred to me and they're taking me two antidepressants and maybe two anti-anxiety agents, and they are not feeling better. And clearly they wouldn't be seeing me if they felt better. So with that raises the question to me. First off, I'll say I am not a psychiatrist. I do not prescribe medications. But I've had over two decades experience of working with people with medications, as I say, a lot of face-to-face time with it. And a cautionary statement might be, you know, if you are max dosed on a medication and you're not feeling better, I think it's wise to ask the psychiatrist or the provider, you know, to check this out, to look closer at it. You know, and sometimes you may find that it's not the medication that's the issue. It may be the diagnosis that is the issue. So, the next aspect I'm going to talk a little bit about is agendas and stereotypes. And people can have agendas. And so by agendas, I mean, for instance, if you go to the doctor the medical doctor, and they want to get a history from you. They're going to ask you for, you know, everybody's past health record, whether that's cardiovascular disease, diabetes, cancer, you name it. And people really have no problem providing that. Now, as a therapist, you go down to ask people about mental health history, you might as well scratch your head and go grab something to eat, because basically, more times than not, people are going to say, no, you know, I don't know anybody, no grandmas, no aunts, no, I don't know anybody, you know, with depression, anxiety, or bipolar. And they're not necessarily lying, because generations back, people didn't get help, okay? It was a big stigma. It was a huge problem. So people had to develop alternative coping strategies. And some of those were not so helpful. Some of those involved alcohol, drugs, and anything else you could to feel like you could stabilize your mood. So keep that in mind. You know, don't expect to get a mental health history that looks good. In fact, expect the opposite. A lot of times, I have noticed that if you diagnose one person in the family, somebody usually pops up and says, oh, that's like me, or whatever. I call it reverse diagnosis. So the medical field gets to move forward, you know, from a historical aspect forward in diagnosing people. And we're all over the place in psychology because we're kind of forced, because there's a lot of people saying, no, not really, don't see it. And like I said, there were reasons for that, and there were good reasons for that. There was a lot of stigma attached. Nowadays, you know, there is much more of an open mind, and I think we are getting much more progressive. So, you know, people are willing to look at some of those aspects. I will say that as another cautionary tale, you know, if you have some of those people that say, oh, so-and-so, you know, she just likes to be dramatic, I say caution to that, because there are people that get things in their life that they did not ask for, okay, and don't necessarily have coming. They may be surrounded by high volume stress and such. So be cautious in just assuming that somebody just is attention seeking or, quote, likes drama. Because I have spoken, like I said, over 20 years experience in the seat, and that's generally not the equation that people want to deal with. That's generally not what they're looking for. I have respected people's journeys, and many people's journeys are tough, but they move forward, and I think that mood disorders are very, very treatable. So the idea is to kind of take some of the stigma off, and let's look at what some of these factors are. And the last area I'm going to cover is agendas, in the sense that, you know, people say, what's the hardest diagnosis to work with? I would say, it's not a diagnosis that's the hardest. It's a style, and it's a defensiveness. And people who are defensive are hard to work with, because usually they've been surrounded by people who have authority issues or have abused authority, and make a person feel less than or weak. And so a person is going to develop more of a defensive style. Those are the people that can cause some setbacks in terms of treatment, whether that's related to the client. You know, it could be your partner, or it could be a parent. I would just say, you know, if you are that person, please reconsider that position. It's okay to have questions, absolutely, and to be able to dialogue with the therapist or the psychiatrist. I think that's important. But if you throw a wall to treatment, I've seen this a lot with kids. Kids know what parents' agendas look like. They know what you can handle generally and what you cannot handle. So kids may dumb down their symptoms just to make you feel better because they know you're not a fan of treatment or you want this thing to be done already, or you don't believe in psychology or treatment thereof or psychiatry. I would just say, if you're that person, by all means, sit down with a provider, throw out your questions, throw out your concerns. And I think, because if you hold the position that you're holding, it can have a really tough impact on the client that's surrounding you. If not a hindrance, at the very least a hindrance, it can be a potential crisis upcoming. You certainly don't want to wait till something kind of builds on itself. I think at this point, I'm going to close this podcast. I feel I've covered a fair amount of terrain. I thank you for joining me. I can be reached at drlaurengoodall@gmail.com. The book is Bipolar is Not an STD on Amazon. And hopefully you have some interest in that topic of mood disorders and personality disorders. And I look forward to you joining me in a future podcast. Thank you. Hi, welcome to my podcast. I am Dr. Lauren Goodall. I'm a clinical psychologist, and I am discussing my book, which is Bipolar is Not an STD. It is available on Amazon, and I am taking excerpts from the book for discussion. But before we do that, I'd like to say Happy New Year. And what goes with New Year's is usually goals. And so before I start, I'd like to talk a little bit about that. Most people set some type of goal up for the new year, and we're actually pretty good at setting up some type of behavioral goal, and we're good at identifying the steps involved in that goal, okay? And we usually have some pretty good thoughts and pretty good reasoning behind it. The thoughts and the goal will usually align. That's what we target. We don't have thoughts that don't align with our goal, because that will never work, okay? So it's great to have the goals, but one factor I think that people fail to take into account is motivation. And motivation is huge. Motivation is that energy. It's that go-through. It's the thing that kicks you out of the box when obstacles come forth, okay? So your motivation is one of the biggest pieces of the equation in being able to achieve any goal you set, okay? So I think most people understand how important motivation is, but somehow when we're setting these goals, we don't factor it into the equation quite as well. So that is my caution. Make sure that even though a goal sounds good, if you're really not in it, then you really don't want to set it up, okay? Because the motivation does need to be present, okay? Motivation is a huge factor. And so much so that a typical daily example might be, say when you pick up your cup of coffee in the morning, okay? Why do people pick up coffee? Well, actually, it gives them energy, it gives them concentration, it gives them ability to focus and to motivate, okay? So that is just, even though, and technically, in terms, it's a stimulant, and it basically is a shot of adrenaline. So when you're having your cup of coffee, you're having a shot of adrenaline, okay? So adrenaline in small doses is fine. It's just when adrenaline gets large, that's when it gets problematic. So that's just a daily example of, you know, increasing motivation and energy and such that we use oftentimes without really being aware of it. Okay, I am going to talk about the term mental health, you know, and versus medical, and is mental health medical? And I'm going to discuss that a bit at length today. And certainly I see it along that paradigm. Mental health, first of all, the term mental has always been problematic because it's used in a derogatory term, in a derogatory way, okay? Of course, most of us understand, and I think we're actually getting better at understanding what mental health is. But for generations and decades, it's kind of been used in a not so great way, you know. He's mental, she's mental, it's mental. So the term itself is problematic. All right, so I am going to switch now to using more of a medical example of mental health, okay? So your brain, to explain that, I'm gonna start talking about the medical systems in your body. We know what the cardiovascular system is, that's heart health, right? The respiratory system, that's lungs and diaphragm, okay? You have an endocrine system, you have a reproductive system, but rather than go through all these different systems, I am going to talk about the limbic system, okay? And why the limbic? Okay, the limbic system is important, and I would say it's very much a mental health correlate, okay? It talks, the limbic system identifies emotions such as sadness, anger, fear, and joy, okay? It also is involved in emotional regulation of behavior, okay? It's got, certainly there is a, the fight or flight system is involved with it, okay? Which is really important, part of the limbic system. And what is the fight or flight system? That's when your brain drops adrenaline, messages for adrenaline like go, 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 okay? Those are in dangerous situations, you know, where you get more superhuman strength that you otherwise wouldn't have. And why is that? Because the brain shuts off all other processes that are less important, like digestion, when it decides that you are in danger, and it basically pounds you with adrenaline, okay? The other part of the system, of the limbic system, is also the de-stress area. Okay, that's where people are accessing it through yoga and mindfulness. Okay, so it's got the fight or flight system, it's got the de-stress system, it's got the emotions and the behavioral part. So, and it also has a memory component, okay? And I'm not gonna identify all these different structures because it's kind of, but they're all structurally within there, okay? There's different structures within the limbic system that govern these pieces. And so, for instance, somebody who goes through trauma, you don't have trauma without traumatic memory, okay? So memory is definitely involved in the limbic system. So for many of these pieces, I am saying instead of mental health, we might as well call it limbic health. Okay, because all of these pieces are structurally in there, okay? And we also have some neurotransmitters in there as well, okay? And I'll start talking about neurotransmitters as we go on. They're chemical messengers in the brain because the brain is constantly sending chemical texts throughout these different systems, okay? It might send a chemical text to the pituitary to drop more growth hormone, okay? Things like that. So you have to understand that the brain is the, shall we say, the chief influencer. But there are all these subsystems that are communicating. And I'm going to talk a little bit about chemical messengers in mental health, which we call neurotransmitters. There are specific ones that I will focus in on a little bit later and not this particular segment. but they're all involved in mood regulation, okay? And to understand a little bit about neurotransmitters, first of all, you have to have a nerve cell, okay? And it's electrical. And basically how it communicates is by sending chemical messages that get picked up, received, read, picked up, dropped more chemical, and so forth down the line, okay? And sometimes the line is interrupted. Okay, and how may it be interrupted? A good metaphor for that is, say you're having a party and you ask somebody to bring a main dish and they say, yeah, great, okay. And then they show up with a dessert instead. And now you are scrambling because you are counting on a main dish and now you have too many desserts and you are scrambling. Okay, so if the wrong chemical decides to sit in the wrong receptor, okay, it's going to create a problem for the brain. The brain is going to have to scramble like you do at the dinner party, how to restructure this, how to go around this, okay? And not only that kind of problem, chemical messengers sometimes show up so that the person who brought the main dish just didn't bring enough of it. So he or she made enough for three and you have 14. And now you're like, wow, I have a problem. Okay, same problem for the brain. The brain is saying, oh my gosh, I've got all these neurotransmitters and now you show up. I've got these senders and receivers, but now you show up, but you didn't bring enough chemical. Okay, and why is that important? Because the person is going to experience symptoms. There is going to be an experience, okay? A physical symptomatology, an emotional symptomatology based on how this sending and receiving system works, okay? There are genetic influences on how well, or genetic predispositions that will say how well this system works, okay? So what I'm going to do at this point is say, okay, this is the backdrop, or what I refer to as the biology or the undercurrent, okay? So when a person comes into therapy, okay, they come into therapy because there might be something going on, okay, in a relationship, job, they're experiencing some level of psychological stress. And through the process of therapy, they're able to get, assess patterns behind it, history behind it, different ways to modify. And they start to make improvements and the psychological distress starts to fall off. And that's perfect because that's what we want. That's what we're here for. Okay. All right. So that happens to one subset of the population. Okay. Another subset of the population will come in, same process, go through the emotional processing, the background, the history, how to change things, modifications, patterns, thought patterns, and such. And the person starts making gains, as which we would expect. Okay, and then all of a sudden, they plateau. Well, we don't like plateaus. And the reason why we don't like them in weight loss, we don't like them when we're trying to get muscle mass, okay, we don't like plateaus. And the reason why we don't like plateaus is because they're usually just shy of falling back, okay, falling backwards, okay, where a person actually starts to have breakthrough psychological symptoms, okay, that is not far behind, okay. So at those points, now we're going to start thinking, I'm going to start thinking, okay, something is going on. There is a root that's missing here, okay? They were doing well. They are now not doing well, or they're sliding back, and they're only getting limited gains. Okay, so now it's time to look at brain biology, neurotransmitters, things along those lines that affect psychological stress in the body, okay? So, and affect mood regulation, okay? So now we're going to start looking at those things that I just discussed with you, okay? Neurotransmitters, the limbic system, the fight or flight system. Okay, so I'm going to read from the book, and it says, Cracking the Code, Mental versus Medical. So some people come in, the psychological agitation or upset was actually caused by an event, a situational stressor, and it gets resolved, and it's good, okay? It's resolved, and they get better, okay? I also believe that the reason some people don't get better and stay better is that there are underlying medical factors, okay, that trigger and cause the mood symptoms, such as severe depression, anxiety, or bipolar. So the psychological distress can be the starting point that is actually more of a medical space, as I've discussed with you, okay? For many, psychological symptoms are rooted in a situation, as I said, and that will always be a factor, but we're going to see some results with this. But when they set back, however, for others, the psychological agitation or upset was started by the brain's cell messengers that overreacted. So in other words, you might think it's situational, and many times we do. Well, I'm just stressed because I'm going through this divorce, and that, of course, is causing a huge amount of stress, or I'm stressed because this job is completely overwhelming, but what you may not be factoring in, because you can't see it, is that your brain chemistry, your cell messengers, are being a bit reactive, okay? They can be overreactive, okay? And the way to recognize that is if you've ever spoke to a person who had post-traumatic stress disorder, okay? They visibly carry a level of agitation, okay? So their cells are firing, seeing threats in so many different places. So their cells are overreacting, and I say, or underreacted, okay, leaving a person feeling miserable or ready to jump out of their skin. Underreacted is kind of how might a person respond with an underreaction would be more like no energy, no motivation, okay? So those would be some places that we would look. And I say, because of this medical chemical reaction or subpar response, the person will have a much more difficult time, quote, snapping out of it. So you're going to see if there is a biological underpinning attached to the stress, they're going to have a harder time working it through. And at which time you're going to be seeking out a psychiatrist for med management or a psychiatric nurse for medication management and trying to determine, are your symptoms more of a depressive nature? Are they more of an anxious nature? Or is there difficulties with energy and motivation and all of that? Those are all our little flags that say something else is going on. So I think it's really important, as I said, when people stop getting better, that you start looking at these biological underpinnings, okay, and start looking there. And so brain biology has to be assessed to continue to have improved gains. You know, if a person's symptomatic, that's kind of a flag, okay? Signs of psychological stress is a flag. And if you can't work it through one way, then you need to start looking at some medication management and such to just kind of recalibrate the system, okay? Some people recalibrate with very little amounts, and other people require a little bit more. But again, that would be, that decision would be made through the doctor for medication management. All right, so I'm going to close this. I'm just going to say that for a lot of these reasons, that's why I think the term mental health should be redefined in terms of being called limbic health. And it's just another system. And brain biology is definitely involved. So it's not necessarily always what happens to you. It also depends on the level of stress, biological stress and psychological stress in the equation. All right. Thank you for joining me.